Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the ADA Federal Update, 21st Anniversary of the ADA. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require audio assistance during the conference, please press star then zero to reach an operator. I would now like to turn the call over to Robin Jones.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to the call today and this session, which is celebrating the 21st anniversary of the ADA. This is part of our monthly ADA audio conference series, which is sponsored by the ADA National Network, which is comprised of the 10 regional ADA centers. We're glad that everyone could join us today, and I know that this is often a much anticipated session. I was just going through some of our records, and we've been holding these programs since 1998, and we've held this session every year since that time period. And so this marks, another milestone of another year to celebrate and as well as provide people an opportunity to get an update of what's happening at the federal level. We're pleased to have two excellent speakers with us today representing both the Department of Justice and the Equal Opportunity Commission to give us some highlights of what's been happening and what is happening in their agencies. But before I do that, their introductions, I just want to go through some of the logistics so that we all know what's happening. We do have people joining us today by both telephone as well as streaming audio, and also individuals who are using real-time captioning via the Internet. Individuals on the telephone will be given an opportunity with instructions from our operator to ask questions. Those of you that are using real-time captioning, if you would convey your questions through the captioner, she will then, or he, will then alert us and enter your question to us. And those that are on streaming audio, if you use the interface available to you to submit a question, we'll make sure that it gets introduced to our presenters. We do find that this session often generates a lot of questions, and we hope to get as many questions in as possible today. This session is also being recorded, and an archive of it will be available following the session in about 5 business days, both a written transcript as well as an audio recording at the www.ada-audio.org website. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and just do a short introduction of our presenters before I turn things over. Now, many of you who have been joining us for over the years are used to hearing the voice of John Wodech, who is formerly the chief of the Disability Rights Section in the U.S. Department of Justice. He has retired officially, and he has been replaced, and never actually replaced, but a very qualified person has been named in his position, and that is Allison Nickel, who is now the chief of the Disability Rights Section within the Department of Justice. She oversees litigation and regulatory and policy development under the Americans with Disabilities Act, Rehabilitation Act, and the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. She also serves as on the national part of the national strategy on HIV and AIDS, and is nationally known as an employment and trial lawyer and lecturer on ADA and HIV and AIDS discrimination issues, trial practice, and strategy. She also is, in her busy life, an adjunct professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center, where she teaches disability discrimination law. Our second speaker represents the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, is Joyce Walker-Jones, and she is a senior attorney in the Americans with Disabilities Act and Genetic Information Discrimination, Non-Discrimination Act Policy Division, that's a mouthful, in the Office of the Legal Counsel at the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Washington, D.C. She's involved with and oversees commission development of commission guidance, conducting training, providing technical assistance to federal government, state agencies, public and private sector employers and employees, human resource managers, and disability rights advocates on Title I of the ADA and Title II of GINA. She was principal drafter of several ADA guidances and also has been a member of various presidential and interagency ADA task forces. She's a graduate of Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, and Chicago Kent College. She's a hometown Chicago girl, of law in Chicago. And she has been an attorney at the EEOC since 1987. So I think, as you can see by their brief bios, both are very competent and highly qualified to be able to speak to all of us today. So we're going to go in the order of the fact that Allison is going to speak first about the Department of Justice. We'll then turn it over to Joyce to speak about the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and then we'll open it up at the end for questions for everybody. So we will be taking questions all at once at the end, and again, we'll be providing you some instructions accordingly. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Allison. Allison, go ahead.
Thanks very much. First of all, good afternoon to everyone, and I just wanted to let folks know who may be in shock that John is now retired. He did put in his 42 years, and we said a very nice and fond farewell to him a few weeks ago, and he's been spending the last 3 weeks in Italy. For those of you who don't know me, I am one of John's longtime deputies here in the section. I've been doing this work with him for about 15 years, so I may be the new section chief, but I'm certainly not new to the section, and of course was fortunate enough to learn this business from, you know, one of the best guys in it. So I hope that my name will become more familiar to you over time. In terms of the update that I'm going to give you, just to give you a little order to my presentation, I'm going to start with the enforcement update, and then probably do a separate piece on Olmstead, and then go through a regulatory update, and then our technical assistance, things that we've done recently. So let me begin the enforcement update. I tried to pick a variety of subject areas. So let me start first with transportation and talk about our settlement with the Megabus bus company. I'm not sure where everyone is from or how familiar you might be with the Megabus system, but here in Washington, New York, D.C., Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Boston, there's this company called Megabus, and it's really a low-cost alternative to the Amtrak to get from cities on the eastern seaboard, primarily back and forth to each other, but mostly back and forth to New York. And by low cost, the tickets can be as cheap as $20. So it's become a very popular mode of transportation between here and New York. This case was started by a complaint from a man who got a round-trip Megabus ticket getting from Baltimore to New York. And he's a person who uses a wheelchair. The outgoing trip from Baltimore to New York went fine. The bus was accessible. However, on the return trip, despite the fact that he and his wife had reserved a bus that was accessible to him as a wheelchair user, they didn't send one. And there was no way to ameliorate that situation in time for them to get back to Baltimore in a timely fashion. And so they ended up putting him in his wheelchair on the bus without using a ramp, which, as you know, is incredibly dangerous and a very dicey undertaking, although he was not injured. They also made him transfer into a seat as opposed to securing him in his wheelchair, which is, again, not just a violation but can be both dangerous and a very dicey event as well. So we undertook an investigation and entered into a settlement with them. The settlement terms, the first of which, of course, is the Megabus fleet will be 100% accessible. And they had a trouble here. One of the things we found out during the investigation was that the bus stop for the Megabus here in Washington, D.C., was not sufficiently accessible for wheelchair users to be able to board and get off the bus easily, so we've made them make some changes to the location of that to make it more accessible. They are paying a civil penalty in the amount of $55,000, and for those of you who don't know, that's money paid to the federal government sort of as a fine, and also paying compensatory damages to the complainant in the amount of $12,500. So moving from transportation to education, let me tell you now about our agreement with the Alexandria Country Day School. This is a case that was started by a complaint by the parents of a girl who was then 6 years old who has type 1 diabetes. And the school denied their daughter admission to the school because she had type 1 diabetes. And they did not want to have to be responsible for, nor did they feel they were legally responsible for helping to test and monitor her blood glucose levels or administer insulin. We entered into agreement with them, in which they will no longer turn away children who, on the basis that they have type 1 diabetes, and they will provide training to their personnel who may be, charged with the responsibility for looking after children with type 1 diabetes, which will include a general diabetes training, how to recognize symptoms of hypoglycemia and hyperglycemia, ways to get help quickly for those two conditions, and how to assist these children in any other way that they need in order to make sure that they can safely be in school. The next agreement that I'm going to talk about is a very large agreement. You may have read about this in the newspaper. It got a lot of press, in part because the damage award is up to $16 million. And this is our very large settlement with Wells Fargo, which is has banks and a whole series of different kinds of financial institutions. And this came about initially because we got 15 or 16 complaints from all over the country, basically alleging the same thing against Wells Fargo, and that is that they were not accepting relay calls from people who were deaf. And instead of accepting them, they were telling the relay operators to have the individuals who were deaf call their TTY number, and then when they would call the TTY number, nobody would answer it. So it was a complete lack of understanding about accepting relay calls and their obligations toward their clients who are deaf or hard of hearing. As we continued to investigate, we found some other things that Wells Fargo was doing that were problematic with respect to people with disabilities, like refusing to provide auxiliary aids and services for complex financial transactions, refusing to provide things in alternate format. They had some barrier removal, architectural barriers in some of their financial institutions. Their ATMs weren't necessarily compliant. So it's a very comprehensive agreement. It reaches beyond the issue that was presented for people who are deaf and hard of hearing and goes into kind of a range of disabilities. I think that's an important thing to note. And in addition to all of the policy changes that will be necessary in order to make sure that all of the people with disabilities who are customers are dealt with effectively, they have set up a fund of up to $16 million. So there is a whole process whereby individuals who were harmed by the policies of Wells Fargo can file complaints with the Department of Justice, and an assessment will be made of those complaints and then a determination as to whether or not they're deserving of some of the claimant funds. In addition to that, Wells Fargo voluntarily decided they wanted to give $1 million to three organizations that support specifically veterans with disabilities, and they have now done that. So the claims process is ongoing. One of the things we're trying to do is get the word out to as many folks as possible. We're advertising in newspapers, using any other kind of message movement that we can to reach out to people who may have been harmed by these practices to get them to file a claim with us. Moving back a little bit now into the education sector, this is a case called CC versus Cypress School District, which occurred in the Central District of California. And this is representative of what we're seeing as a little bit of a trend in both elementary and middle school that is tied, I think, in part to the rising rates of autism and autism spectrum disorder that we're seeing. This is a situation we were not directly involved in this lawsuit. We did not bring this lawsuit ourselves. Rather, private party brought it against the school district, and then the Justice Department came in and filed what's called a statement of interest, which is sort of a legal analysis to help the court decide whether or not a violation of the law took place. This case involved a 7-year-old with autism spectrum disorder who was almost completely nonverbal, and he acquired a service dog that was incredibly helpful to him. And in fact, the first word he said as a verbal kid for the first time at 7 was the name of this dog. So the school was completely resistant to the notion that this 7-year-old could bring the dog to the classroom with him. And so that's really what the lawsuit was about. And our view, of course, was that reasonable modifications of policies meant that the school had to allow this child with autism spectrum disorder to, in fact, keep this service animal in school with him. And that was the basis of our statement of interest. And while the case is ongoing, at least the preliminary view of the judge, I think, is very positively disposed toward, in fact, the dog being allowed to stay with this kid in school. And we're seeing, I think, an increasing number of these, and that will probably continue. Somewhat education-related is the case brought by the National Federation for the Blind against the Law School Admissions Council. For those who don't know what the Law School Admissions Council is, they do two things. They administer the law school admissions test, which is a test you have to take in order to get into law school. But the other thing they do is they are the primary conduit for kids now to bundle their applications to law school. So you put all your stuff together, you send it to the Law School Admissions Council, and they send it along with your LSAT score out to the law schools. That's the process that was at issue in the National Federation of the Blind lawsuit. Because of that process whereby LSAC has you give them all your documents and then they send them out to the law schools was completely inaccessible to people who are blind and have low vision. And so they brought suit against LSAC. In the meantime, NFB filed with us a series of individual complaints against individual law schools, essentially saying, look, these law schools should not be using the LSAC website for their students, or they should not be accepting these applications from LSAC, because what happens is if you're a blind kid and you want to apply, for instance, to the John Marshall Law School, and you can't use this process, you have to send in hard copies. So you're immediately identified as a person with a disability. So we were, although we weren't directly involved in the lawsuit, this is a little tricky, we were involved in the settlement, and LSAC has promised now to make that, within a year, to make that process completely accessible. And we entered into actually a separate settlement with the John Marshall Law School, and we're working on others where they are agreeing to refrain from accepting applications from LSAC until and unless it is fully accessible. Moving now to Olmsted, and of course, you know, we have a huge push on Olmsted, and let me start by one, you know, sort of inserting one technical assistance piece here. We now have on, you know, our website is ada.gov. We now have a separate page just for Olmsted matters. So if you have a particular interest in the Olmsted work that we're doing, it is now all collected on a single page. So if you go to ada.gov, the very first link under What's New, you'll see the Olmsted page. And it lists all of the statements of interest that we filed, all of the amicus briefs we filed, and settlements we've had, cases that we've brought ourselves. So it's all cataloged in that one place. To give you just one of our most recent examples of our Olmsted work, and of course there are many, is our settlement with the state of Delaware. And that agreement dealt with Delaware's state-operated psychiatric hospitals. And the agreement provides relief for more than 3,000 individuals who are unnecessarily institutionalized in Delaware's in those psychiatric hospitals and people who are at risk of becoming institutionalized in those hospitals because of the lack of community support. And as you might imagine, these Olmsted agreements are very thorough and very complicated because they deal with each state's system for doing things on an individualized basis. But just to give you a sense of the kind of things that will be changing in Delaware that will lead to deinstitutionalization and prevent further institutionalization, the state of Delaware is increasing its case management supports, its crisis walk-in centers, its mobile crisis teams, its crisis stabilization services, its peer-run crisis apartments, the statewide crisis hotline. There will be four intensive case management teams, each serving approximately 800 people. There will be targeted case management. They'll have 25 case managers serving approximately 875 people. There will be discharge planning, supported employment within the community, rehabilitative services, family and peer supports. So there's a very comprehensive change that needs to be undertaken once you begin to deinstitutionalize people. In other words, it's more than just moving them to another setting. It's making sure that when they're in that setting, rehabilitative services and methods of thriving are available to them in that new setting. So let me move from the enforcement side now to the regulatory side. As you know, we published four ANPRMs last July. The comment period for those closed in January of this year. On the web accessibility ANPRM, we have received 440 public comments. On the movie captioning ANPRM, we have received 1,171. For the next generation 911 ANPRM, we have received 146 comments. And for the accessible equipment and furniture, which of course includes medical equipment, we have received 420 public comments, and we now are reviewing those comments. And as you know, during the comment period, although I can, this is really more for the Q&A period, I certainly can listen to any concerns or thoughts people have about those, but because we're in the middle of the rulemaking process, I can't really engage in a dialogue about those. But I at least wanted to let people know that the comment period is closed and that we did get comments on everything and that we're now reviewing those. The other thing that the Justice Department is responsible for is ensuring that the federal government is complying with Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, which is the part of the Rehabilitation Act that deals with the procurement and deployment and use of electronic technologies and to make sure that those are accessible to everyone, both in terms of buying them and using them within the federal government, but also making sure that people who are trying to have communication with the federal government from the outside, for instance, via our websites, are able to do that. And we here are responsible for compiling a report on a yearly basis that then is eventually sent to the President and to the Congress detailing the extent to which the federal government either is or isn't in compliance with 508, including our own agency, the Department of Justice. So this year's survey closed on May 20th, and 89 agencies and more than 450 individuals from those agencies were involved in the surveying. The data is transmitted to us now electronically, so it's very easy for the federal agencies to report the data to us. That just closed in May, so it takes a good deal of time to then analyze the data. And that data, once it's analyzed, will be used as the basis for our report to the President and to the Congress on the state of 508 compliance within the federal government. So that you'll have to look for that in the future. We have two new technical assistance documents up on our website. One is our new TA document on service animals. And the second is a TA piece on ticketing. So those are currently available on the website. The other, the last thing that I'll talk about in terms of TA is, I've told you we have a separate Olmstead page. We just launched also last week a separate page for HIV and AIDS. I think as you heard earlier, I am in charge of the Justice Department's responsibilities under the President's National AIDS Strategy. And one of the things that we had heard from advocates for a long time is that there's a lack of pipeline, if you will, for folks to know how to file a complaint of HIV discrimination with us. And I think that's because unlike folks with some other kinds of disabilities, the HIV community has been is more involved with sort of the health literacy end of this and less involved with the civil rights aspect of it, whereas with other disability organizations, I think it's more balanced between health literacy and civil rights. And so one of the things that this HIV/AIDS page allows people to do is it's a one-click system for filing a complaint. You go on, there's an icon, you click on it, and you can file a complaint directly with us. And we're hoping that that fosters our ability to be able to fetter out HIV discrimination, which we think is vastly underreported, and to respond to the concerns of the constituents. I think for me, that's probably a good enough place to sort of stop, and then I'll turn it either back to, should I turn it over to Joy?
Yeah, just go ahead and we'll just go ahead and turn it right now over to Joyce.
All right. Thanks, Allison. This was good for me, too, because I got to see what another sister agency is doing. I'm going to talk similar to Allison to give you some updates on what's happening at the EEOC. And I'll start with our most significant accomplishment, which many of you already know about, which is the issuance, the long-awaited issuance of the final rule implementing the ADA Amendments Act. Then I'm going to give you an update on some charges we filed under the ADA, an update on charges we've received, and talk about a few cases and the lessons learned. So as many of you probably know, on March 24th, EEOC finally issued its final regulations to implement the ADA Amendments Act, which became effective January 1st, 2009. So we were getting a lot of calls and questions about when the final rule would be out. And as many of you probably know, that takes a very long time. We also put out a notice of proposed rulemaking to seek comments before we issued the final regulations, and we did that in 2009. And we held a series of town hall meetings to solicit comments, and I don't have the figures at hand, but we received well into the, I'm sure, high hundreds, maybe even thousands of comments from a broad spectrum of people, stakeholders, employers and advocates for people with disabilities, from people with disabilities themselves. And we cataloged all of those, we looked at them all, we debated them, and, you know, ultimately it's up to our commission to vote on the final regs, which they finally did, and then it goes to OMB. And so, as I said, following that long, involved process, we did finally issue regulations in March. Those of you who are familiar with the regulations should know that they closely track the statute itself, so I'm not going to go through a lot of detail because I assume that many of you have either have looked at the regs yourselves or been to training on the regs. You should know that we only revise those portions of the regulations and the appendix that were affected by the amendments. And basically the regulations set forth a list of principles to guide the determination of whether or not a person has a disability. For example, the principles provide that impairment need not prevent or seriously restrict the performance of a major life activity to be considered a disability. As many of you will know, that this is really huge because most people filing a claim under the ADA got stopped at the door, meaning that courts found that they didn't have a disability, therefore you never got to the merits of their complaints. Congress decided that was not the intent of the original ADA at all, and so the overarching purpose of the amendments is to make it easier for people to file complaints of discrimination, that the definition of disability stress should be construed broadly. So the principles also provide that with one exception, and that is ordinary eyeglasses or contact lenses, mitigating measures such as medication and assistive devices like hearing aids must not be considered when determining whether or not someone has a disability. As many of you are aware, that was a big hurdle. When EEOC originally issued regulations in 1991, we said that when you're just assessing whether or not somebody has a disability, you look at the person without regard to mitigating measure. A series of cases decided by the Supreme Court, however, overturned that and said, no, when you're looking at whether somebody has a disability, you look at that person with their assistive devices, you look at that person on medication. Congress said no when you're assessing, in essence, that EEOC is right. When you're assessing whether or not somebody has a disability, you look at that person without mitigating measures, except when you're, if the impairment involves using ordinary eyeglasses or contact lenses. Another big change, the ADA amendments, the regulations and the ADA Amendments Act explicitly state that impairments that are episodic, such as epilepsy, or in remission, such as cancer, are disabilities if they would be substantially limiting when active. This is also huge because many people who had conditions such as epilepsy were finding it hard to show that they had a disability if they did not have seizures all of the time. Congress said that's not necessary. A person doesn't have to have the effects of the impairment don't have to be present 24/7 in order for that person to be covered. So that means that a person who has epilepsy, even if they only have seizures infrequently, or even if they don't have seizures at all, are covered. The same as someone with cancer. They don't have to actively have cancer, but they have to, if they had cancer and that cancer is in remission and that cancer would be a substantial limit of major life activity when active, that person is covered. The regulations also make it easier, as does the statute itself, to establish regarded as coverage. Regarded as coverage used to be a significant hurdle, but now it's easier for individuals to establish because the focus is on how the person was treated rather than on what the employer believed about the nature of the person's impairment. Prior to the Amendments Act, the person had to show that the employer believed or perceived them to be substantially limited in a major life activity. Now that's not necessary. All the person has to show is that they were subjected to an adverse action, not hired, fired, not selected for promotion because of an impairment, and that impairment meets their definition regarded as long as it's not transitory, meaning lasting or expected to last 6 months or less, and not minor. The other big change to the ADA was that now there is a second list of major life activities, and that list is major bodily functions, which will make it easier for people with conditions like cancer and HIV and diabetes and epilepsy to show that they have a disability, and they don't have to resort to the sort of task-oriented activities or life function activities such as, you know, eating, sleeping, taking care of oneself, concentrating. Before the ADA Amendments Act, that was a list that we had to resort to, and even though that list is not finite, for some conditions it made it harder to show that a person was a person with a disability. But now with the list of major bodily functions added as major life activity, that'll be the first list you look to with certain conditions. In addition to issuing the final rule, we are also currently updating our enforcement guidances and our technical assistance documents to reflect the changes made by the amendments. And we're also looking at whether we need to issue a new document that addresses reasonable accommodation in one piece. You may be aware that we have many technical assistance documents, and many of them address issues of reasonable accommodation. For example, we have a series of question and answer documents on specific impairments such as diabetes and epilepsy and intellectual disabilities. And in those documents, we address reasonable accommodation issues that might be common for those particular disabilities. We've also issued a document on performance and conduct that addresses reasonable accommodation. We've issued a document on accommodation issues for applicants. And we recently had a commission meeting to address reasonable accommodation, and one of the suggestions was that because reasonable accommodation is probably going to become a big issue now that the issue of coverage is not going to be major, that we should think about issuing a document that addresses reasonable accommodation in one issue. Let me talk a little bit about charges. We've already seen a significant increase in ADA charges since the ADA Amendments Act took effect on January 1st, 2009. More than 25,000 ADA charges were filed with EEOC in fiscal year 2010, and that fiscal year 2010 ended on September 30th, 2010, up from about 7,000 from fiscal year 2008. As of April 2011, EEOC has filed 18 cases under the ADA Amendments Act. I'm sure we filed more in the last 3 months. the most frequently seen condition or charge that we have seen has alleged that the person's been discriminated against based on cancer, which before the ADA Amendments Act was hard to prove, believe it or not, because of the need to show that the cancer is substantially limited in major life activity. Again, usually you had to resort to activities such as ability to take care of oneself or working. Now, with the new list of major bodily functions as a major life activity, it's easier to show that cancer is a disability because cancer, by definition, substantially limits normal cell growth. I neglected to mention that also in the regulations, we have a list of disabilities that we think almost always or virtually always will be a disability. It's not intended to be a per se list, but they based on the nature of some disabilities, cancer being one of them, intellectual disabilities and epilepsy, cancer being others, we think that those disabilities require so little individualized assessment to show that they are disabilities. We're also litigating some of the other disabilities we're litigating, diabetes, seizure disorder, bipolar, hemophilia. We also filed our first case with a charging party that has dwarfism, and this case is against Starbucks. You may have seen our news press release. In this case, the charging party was hired by Starbucks to work in a consumer service position, but she was only allowed to train for 3 days before she was fired. The job description was for a barista position, and it stated that no prior experience was required. But soon after being hired, the charging party asked to use a stool or a small step ladder to perform the essential functions of preparing orders and serving customers at the counter. Starbucks disregarded her request and refused to consider her use of a stool or step ladder. And on the same day that she requested accommodation, Starbucks terminated her employment, claiming that she could pose a danger to customers and employees. We're arguing that the charging party has a disability because she's substantially limited in a major bodily function involving the musculoskeletal system. And we're also alleging that she could have been accommodated without imposing an undue hardship. Our most frequently filed class cases involve policies based on fixed leave and where employers won't grant additional leave as a reasonable accommodation. I'll talk about a couple of those cases in a minute. In fact, let's go now to talk about some of the litigation. These cases that I'm going to talk about, two big ones, were settled in 2009, 2010, but I think they're still really important. These cases allege a failure to accommodate where employers have fixed leave policy, and typically the policy was that if you're on leave for more than a year, you're out of the door. So the two cases I'm going to discuss, one's EEOC versus Sears Roebuck. We actually filed the case in 2004, and we settled it in 2009. For almost $6.3 million. It's the largest monetary award in a single EEOC ADA case. And the money was distributed among 253 class members with an average distribution of $26,300 per class member. And this case involved a service technician. It started off with a service technician whose job was to repair refrigerators and washing machines in customers' home. It was physically demanding work. One day he was injured when he fell down the stairs of the customer's home and he hurt his knee, back, and ankle. Because he could no longer get down on the floor and work on appliances, he took workers' comp leave. He asked to return to a job at Sears that was less physically strenuous. He applied to become a service manager and dispatcher, and those were jobs that were both open for which he was qualified, but Sears said no. After his 1 year of leave ran out, he was fired. In the course of investigating this charge, we discovered a class of other employees who had been placed on leave, had never been seriously considered for reasonable accommodation, and after a year were put on the street. The consent decree requires Sears to designate a core group to review all requests for accommodations, and this group also has to authorize any terminations due to exhaustion of leave. Communications were also overhauled, and employees are now informed by certified mail of their right to request accommodation and the types of accommodations available, including reassignment. A similar case, and these were cases that were filed at our Chicago office, so I'm sure Robin knows of these. The second case was EEOC versus SuperValu, and it was filed in 2009 and settled in 2010 for $3.2 million, with relief divided among 111 claimants for an average award of nearly $29,000. And like Sears, SuperValu had a one-year disability leave policy, but as part of the injunctive relief, consent decree requires the employer to hire a job descriptions consultant to ensure that the job descriptions accurately describe the requirements of its position. Old descriptions, for example, included lifting requirements like 80 pounds for checkout line cashier position. But testimony, as well as observations of any of us who have ever been through a grocery store, grocery line, indicated that virtually no employee ever did such lifting. Instead, cashiers use a scanning wand to scan heavy purchases, and certainly in this economy, probably no one could afford 80 pounds of groceries in one visit. Supervisor also required is also required to hire a job accommodations consultant, develop a list of common accommodations that may be offered to employees with common restrictions. And the reason I mentioned these two cases, even though they were filed prior to the ADA Amendments Act, I think is because employers can learn valuable lessons from these cases. The first one being, of course, that an inflexible period of leave, even if substantial, is not enough to satisfy an employer's duty of reasonable accommodation. Employees that offer disability leave tend to see that period of leave as all that is necessary, but reasonable accommodation requires more than putting an employee on leave and waiting to see if the employee heals 100% and return to the same job he has before he went on leave. Leave may be appropriate accommodation in some cases, but in other cases, the employer must determine whether there is any other accommodation, like reassignment or reduced hours. And again, because we believe that coverage is going to be so much easier and that employers are not going to win by saying that a person is not covered on the ADA, we are going to get to the merits of more accommodation issues, and employers need to be aware that they may need to adjust and amend their policies. Another lesson to be learned from this case is that the appropriate length of leave under the ADA requires an individualized analysis, even if the employer has given a generous fixed leave policy. So again, just because employers offered 1 year of leave before terminating a person, they still need to engage in individualized analysis to determine whether additional leave may be appropriate accommodation. Leave that can never be extended is not consistent with the ADA. As a best practice, fixed leave policy should be amended to make clear that the leave period can be extended or adjusted as a reasonable accommodation where such extension or adjustment would not result in undue hardship. Another lesson employers should learn from these cases is that separating leave administration, like the administration of workers' compensation benefits or disability benefits, from the ADA administrators is risky. And there seems to be a trend toward outsourcing benefits administration for employees on leave. This is what Sears and SuperValu did. But this often results in the left hand failing to know what the right hand is doing. So the information collected for benefits administration by the employer often is not used by the ADA administrators at the same employer to determine whether the employee on leave can be brought back to work with a reasonable accommodation. Another lesson is that clear lines of communication regarding reasonable accommodation are critical, not only for employees on leave, but also their health care providers, supervisors, and managers. And best practices, we think, require communication about the availability of reasonable accommodation with players at all levels of the leave process. This means an employee should know about that he or she might be able to return to work with an accommodation, even if he or she is not 100% healed. And this is important because a lot of times the employee, the handbook may say that only 1 year of leave is available, which may lead an employee to believe that he or she doesn't have a right to ask for any more leave. So the employee should know that even if they're not able to return to work 100%, that they should ask, if they think that there is that there is an accommodation, that they should ask for it. And the employee's health care provider should understand the availability of alternative means of performing work, so that an informed return to work certification can be completed. Managers also who deal with employees returning leave should be educated to support reasonable accommodation requests in the workplace in order to make them reality. The other lesson learned, as these two cases show, is that the commission occupies a unique role in litigating these cases by virtue of the fact that the amount of money that we got, $6.3 million in Sears and $3.2 million in SuperValu. So, not providing a reasonable accommodation can really cost an employer. We also recently just got a big settlement and against Verizon. So big employers should be on alert that failing to provide a reasonable accommodation, failing to do an individualized assessment can be really costly. Some of the more recent cases we filed, we just recently were awarded a $600,000 verdict against AutoZone. It was by a federal jury in Peoria. And in that case, AutoZone failed to provide a reasonable accommodation to a sales manager with a permanent back and neck impairments who was required to perform certain cleaning tasks, including mopping floors. And these tasks violated his medical restrictions. And we presented evidence that mopping floors was a non-essential function of the sales manager's position and could have been reassigned to other employees. So, again, it's really important that employers know that they actually look at and update their position descriptions and make sure that they understand what the essential functions of the job. You know, employers a lot of times get in trouble for using outdated position descriptions, so they don't keep pace with changing technology. As I said, in SuperValue, maybe years and years ago, cashiers were expected to lift heavy objects onto the conveyor belt and then lift those objects into baskets, but now they have scanning wands. But the position descriptions may still show these lifting requirements. The other thing that employers need to be aware of is not focusing on not how a job is done, but what needs to be done. So a lot of times employers confuse certain functions, or they'll have requirements that a job requires standing or lifting or walking when the job actually doesn't require that. That's not why they're hiring somebody to stand, lift, or walk. They're hiring a person to do a specific job. And that may be how that job is accomplished, but that's not the only way that a job is accomplished. Another case that we recently filed was against Inglobal Engineering. That was a case that we filed in Texas. And that company will pay $100,000 and provide additional remedial relief for unlawfully firing an employee because it mistakenly assumed he had MS. In that case, the Chardon party was already working for the company when he started experiencing numbness and tingling in his extremities and told his supervisors that his doctors thought he might have MS. And the supervisor in this case happened to be a part-time paramedic who claimed he was familiar with MS and knew what the symptoms were and knew what the outcome was. And so he immediately recruited somebody else for CP's job and urged him CP to take medical leave, which the CP did, because he told him that MS is very debilitating and he didn't think the company would want to deal with anyone with his disease. CP followed his advice and took medical leave. However, when he obtained a full medical release to return to work without restrictions, he was told that his job was no longer available. So, again, employers are going to have to be really careful about not making decisions based on impairment or perceived impairment because, as I said earlier, showing regarded as coverage is going to be a lot easier. It doesn't mean that the person will automatically win, but it does mean that they make out a claim and then the employer is then going to have to defend its actions. So in this case, the employer would have to show that it fired the person or hired somebody else for his job because it believed that he could no longer do his job. They have to show that he could no longer do his job or that he posed a direct threat. Other cases that we have filed, two employees who were given unlawful medical inquiries. They were asked about whether they had any a number of conditions. And, of course, medical inquiries and exams don't change under the ADA. ADA Amendments Act, so it's still unlawful. A person doesn't actually have to have a disability to make out an unlawful inquiry or exam case. In this case, they asked two employees who had already been working. They had no reason to believe that the employees couldn't do their job. The employer had no reason to believe that the employees posed a direct threat, yet they asked. One employee revealed that he had diabetes. I think another revealed he had hypertension. So when it came time to do a RIF to cut the workforce, the employer actually fired these two employees. And we allege that, you know, but for the employees revealing that they had disabilities, they would not have been fired. I'm going to probably stop there in terms of some of the cases we filed and talk a little bit about, you know, we've been doing a lot of training. I was out with Robin a month or so ago, I guess it was in May, to the ADA symposium. And so when you go out and do these training, you listen to a lot of questions. You hear what's on people's mind. A lot of them are HR people who are actually on the front line. Sometimes they're, other employers. Obviously, the anticipated issue is accommodation. Now that coverage is easier, employers are wondering what's going to happen when they receive too many requests. So there is an anticipation that because more people are covered, that there's going to be a flood of requests. I guess, obviously, the cases we've been seeing have involved a reasonable accommodation. I think time will tell whether or not that continues. I mean, the fear from employers is that people who find out that they're newly covered because of the broadened definitions are certainly going to ask. I think some of that may be true, but I think also that people who already are covered would have been covered before the ADA amendment have not asked for reasonable accommodation, that they continue to work without needing an accommodation, and that includes people with diabetes and epilepsy and cancer, that people, for many reasons, still are not going to want to reveal their disability, therefore not going to ask for anything because of that. Employers are also asking, what happens if they receive too many requests? Should they grant requests on a first-come, first-served basis? The ADA Amendments Act did not change the requirement that you have to grant each reasonable accommodation request if it comes from a qualifying individual with disability, and providing that request would not pose an undue hardship. So there's no such thing as saying, well, we've already granted 100, that's the maximum that we have to grant, and so we're not granting anymore. That's not what the ADA requires. It requires employers to look at each request that comes in and to consider whether or not they have to grant that request. The other thing we're telling employers is that a lot of the stuff they've been doing anyway, without deciding whether or not they have a legal obligation under the ADA, but then when employers come and they need some change or adjustment in the workplace and they value the employee, that they are making those changes without considering whether or not the person is covered, meets the technical definition or the legal definition of disability. Other anticipated issues is how much documentation is enough. Even though now that the definition of disability is broader, people are asking, but we've also said that there's no such thing as a per se disability, so how much documentation? I think in those cases where the disability virtually always will be a disability, such as cancer and diabetes and epilepsy, and certainly people with mobility impairments, that in those cases that the documentation will be minimal. In other cases, I think that it still will not be as extensive, but we are saying that self-diagnosis is not enough, so that it's not enough for a person to come and say, I've been having symptoms and I looked up, Google, or, there are all these websites available, and I think I have diabetes. It's never been confirmed, but I have diabetes, and because of that, I'm asking for a reasonable accommodation. No, self-diagnosis is not enough, but it's probably sufficient for an employer to present documentation that says, from a doctor, that said this person has been diagnosed with diabetes, without saying that it substantially limits, a major bodily function. We've been asked questions about, qualification standards. As I said a minute ago, I think in terms of qualification standards that's going to be an issue. There hasn't been a lot of case law developed on qualification standards because we never really got to the issue of the merits of that. So to the extent, again, that employers have qualification standards that require or say that certain physical qualifications are required for a job, I think employers are going to have to look at that, because I think those kind of standards are going to be challenged. With that, I will move to the one question that I've already received, and it is an accommodation issue, so it seems like this is appropriate segue. Someone submitted a written question about what happens if when an employee discloses a disability but does not request accommodation, and then that employee starts to have performance problems that may or may not be related to disability. And the question is the employer responsible for implementing reasonable accommodations before going through the termination process? And the answer to that is no, and that doesn't change under the ADA. And in our technical assistance piece on performance and conduct issues, we've always talked about, we said that It's always a prospective duty. So from the point that the employer knows that the person has a disability forward, the employer has to consider whether or not reasonable accommodation would help a person meet a performance or conduct standard. If the employee has no reason to know that, and the person has not requested a reasonable accommodation, then the employer is not under any obligation. If termination is what would be the course of action, then the termination proceeds because the person hasn't asked for reasonable accommodation. And the assumption, I mean, and the principle, of course, is just because a person has a disability, there's no reason for the employer to assume necessarily that the performance problems stem from the disability. Of course, you know, common sense is always the way to go. Employer can always ask someone, tell them about the performance problem, say what's going on, why are you having difficulties? That's not a prohibited disability-related inquiry. My favorite question is always, you know, I have an employee that falls asleep all the time. What should I do? And I always answer, wake him up. You know, is not prohibited, even if the employee does have a disability or affecting his ability to stay awake. It's not a violation to wake up a sleep employee, because the presumption is that the essential functions of any job requires a person to be awake. And so, you know, the same thing with performance. Don't let performance problems go on too long. If you suspect that somebody's having a performance problem, certainly they should be documented. It should be brought to the person's attention. And the person should be given an opportunity to say, well, I'm having performance problems because I'm having some medical issues. The other question we were asked is, related question was, if a person discloses a disability but does not request accommodation, but I guess this was a university. University sees that the disability could be a safety concern. Is there an obligation on the university's part to work to resolve the safety concern? And the issue there was that the standard is that you have to have a reasonable belief that the person poses a direct threat, which is a pretty high standard. So it's not just sort of altruistic concerns that this may not be a good job for the person to do or the person may hurt themselves, but if this is a substantial risk of harm that is not remote or speculative, certainly you could start asking questions. And some of those questions may be, you know, more information about the disability, whether or not the person has worked in, you know, a similar job, how they, you know, if it's a, say, for example, if it's epilepsy, how often the person has seizures, whether or not, you know, the seizures are under control, whether or not the person gets some kind of warning that a seizure is coming. So with that, I think we're pretty close to turning it over generally to the audience. Is that true, Robin?
Yes, that's great. Well, thank you, and thank you for addressing that question that had been submitted, and that gets us on the track for taking questions. So, Jamie, I'll ask you to give instructions to the people that are on the phone. Those of you that are online, you can use the processes available to you through that system to submit a question, and we'll convey it to the speakers. So go ahead, Jamie.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star key and then the one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, to ask a question, please press star one.
While we're waiting for people to queue in, Joyce, I do have a question that was submitted online from someone asking specifically, does EEOC have something in writing about the interaction of workers' comp, family medical leave, and the ADA regarding confidential of medical information, since all have very significant restrictions in the use of information needed to determine disability? Any guidance could be provided would be very helpful.
Yes, we have a series of documents on our website, www.eeoc.gov. And if you go to disability and then I think available resources, we have done a Q&A on workers' comp. We've also done one on the interplay between, FMLA and the ADA. I don't have the website open in front of me, but that was, you know, I would certainly suggest you go there first. And if you can't find anything, of course, you can contact me directly, and I'll try to help you navigate our website.
Also, good contact one of the regional ADA centers who are very familiar with your website as well. So that would be at 800-949-4232, both voice and TTY. Thank you. And Jamie, do we have anyone who's queued up for a question?
Our first question comes from Daryl Christensen.
Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Here with Susan Malloy, who has a question.
Hello, thanks for this presentation. It's been great, and I feel very encouraged with the news that you've given us today. I'm in need of a technical assistance document or a website about accommodations for people who have had toxic exposures and are chemically sensitive or who have radio frequency triggered illnesses. And I haven't been able to find much about that yet. For example, in housing, of course, one of the issues would be the new smart meters that are getting installed across the country. Those are forcing people out of their houses. And we don't have any protection from fragrance chemicals or maintenance chemicals in the workplace. And we're very much in need of some guidance and support. And I wondered what's on the books for, or what's in the plans for working on that kind of issue.
This is Joyce. EEOC has not issued any specific technical assistance guidance in this area, but I know that the Job Accommodation Network they have excellent resources for a number of conditions, and I know that they do have suggested or possible accommodations for people with these kind of sensitivities. I don't know what the Job Accommodation Network, the website is offhand. Robin, do you know?
The Job Accommodation Network is askjan.org. So it's askjan.org.
That is a good site. Thanks for that recommendation. I'm thinking that we need something more like some direction from DOJ, I suppose, to federal agencies, saying that we're to be accommodated and no longer are we to be evicted or fired for sport.
Allison or, yeah.
I guess I'm not entirely sure that that's a question so much as a statement.
And I need some help real badly.
I think that my recommendation at this point, Warren, because we do have a lot of people asking questions and stuff, we don't have the ability to take a lot of individualized concerns and questions, would be to, Joyce made an offer for somebody to contact her directly or what you're bringing up is a very difficult issue, and I know that there is not a lot of information out there, so I think it's going to take some effort to try to identify what is out there to help, and then of course, making the federal agencies known that this might be an issue that they need to address if they have not already got it on their radar screen, to do that. So contacting the agencies and working through that, and I don't know if Joyce or Allison have any other comments.
I don't. I think the Jan recommendation was the best.
Mm-hmm. Jan's funded by the Department of Labor, and obviously they're working on various issues and maybe need to be, identified that this is something that needs to be dealt with some more documentation and more resources as well.
So. May I have your contact information, please?
My contact information, it's best to contact me by email, and that would be joyce.walker-jones@eeoc.gov.
One more time, please.
joyce.walker-jones@eeoc.gov.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next question, please.
The next question comes from Kathy Gibbs.
Good. Hi, can you hear me? This is a question for Allison.
Yes.
And Allison, I was just wondering if you could comment on the statement of interest in the CC versus the school district case and how that sort of relates with the Title II regulation that a public entity is not responsible for the care or supervision of a service animal.
Certainly, absolutely. Let me say that what you will read in the statement of interest is our view that in this particular case, that regulation was not implicated because the care was not for the dog so much as it was for the child who was handling the dog. So there, that is one of the issues that was raised in that case. But our view of that was different than the school district's.
So I guess I didn't quite get that. So the school district was responsible for the care supervision of the animal?
The school district was responsible for the care and supervision of the child. And like with all children that age, there are some things that you have to do for them. You know, you help them out with their coats, off with their boots, a number of other things. And tethering and untethering this dog, the service dog, to the 7-year-old kind of falls in that more ministerial category.
Oh, okay. And also things like walking the dog when it has to relieve itself.
The dog did not have to be walked.
Oh.
These are very fact-specific. In this case, the dog did not have to be walked or tended to in those ways during the school day.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. The next question comes from Gary Edler.
I'm going to turn it over to Ronald Jackson to ask the question. Ron?
Hello, everyone. How are you? My question is, if an employee has a disability that is not known, they don't know if it's job-related or not, and the employee can't do their current job, and the company has other jobs that the employee can do, is that company required to give one of those jobs to that employee?
This is Joyce. If the person has a disability, obviously, one of the things that employers can accuse about is a disability does not have to be job-related. If a person has a disability, meaning they have a substantial limit in their substantial limit in major life activity, then they have a disability, and then the question is whether or not they're qualified to do the job. My understanding is you're saying the person's no longer qualified for the job they currently have, and what the ADA requires is then is that employer obligated to reassign that person as a reasonable accommodation. And reassignment means that the person is qualified to do another job that is open. It's currently vacant or it's soon to become vacant, then the employer has to consider that person for the job. The employer does not have to create another job, does not have to train a person to become qualified for a job, but has to consider or not whether the person can be reassigned to available job for which the person is qualified.
Thank you.
I'm showing no further questions from the phone line.
Really, a very silent silent group today.
We actually just get Kathy Gibbs just queued up again.
Oh, okay.
This is a question again for Allison on a whole different subject. We're getting some, I don't know if it's confusion, but federal agencies under Section 504 that are holding entities to the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standard. And I'm just wondering if there's any coordination on the Department of Justice's part to get the federal agencies to change their regulations to either point to the ADA standards for accessible design or the Architectural Barriers Act accessibility standards?
Well, we do coordination with the federal agents all the time on a range of things. Whether that specific issue has been the subject of recent coordination, I'm afraid I don't know.
Thanks.
And we did also just get another question from Daryl Christensen.
Go ahead, please.
I had a question. I would think it was directed to Joyce. You had spoke about the employer and the person with the disability. If the accident happened and it wasn't on the job related, and once the person had the surgery and came back to and not able to do the job that he or she was doing, and they were supposed to be retrained, but then the time frame elapsed, and then they kind of shoved you out the door. What recourse does that person have?
Okay, I'm trying to understand the question. You're saying that a person was injured on the job and has a disability, or injured not on the job? It doesn't matter. If the person was injured, has a disability, they can't come back to the job they had, and they were supposed to be retrained
It's called rehabilitation program, but the insurance company kept prolonging the opportunity to get into the program.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, a year elapsed, and the person wasn't able to get in the training. At the same time, the time expired for he or she could have the medical leave.
Again, I think this is, it's not exactly the situation in Sears and in SuperValu, but it does implicate this 1 year leave policy. And if mm-hmm. The sort of clock is ticking and one year is up, then the person's out. And the ADA says, no, not so fast, that if this person hasn't been accommodated, the employer needs to look at whether or not, they haven't been retrained, whether or not there's another opportunity to continue to complete that training, whether or not there's any other accommodations that allow the person to do that job, whether or not if the person can't do that job with an accommodation, are there jobs to which the person can be reassigned. So what I would say is that the emphasis shouldn't be on, well, a year is up and it didn't happen, so therefore the employer can kind of wipe its hand. That's not true. It's still an ongoing obligation to provide a reasonable accommodation.
And there lies the question for the person, because they aren't knowledgeable to pursue that information that you would think obviously said exists, but they don't know it, and the employer is not giving that information to them. And them by them not knowing, they automatically just go along with what they say.
Right, and I certainly understand that, and that's what happened in the class of the case that we filed against Sears. Employees assumed that because the company policy says that you only have a year, and once that year was up, they were out, that they didn't know that they could pursue. And so this is an issue that that we're aware of. Should we be doing more to as a best policy to make employers make clear, to disseminate information to the workforce to say that, that the 1 year policy that's stated in while it's not illegal in an employee manual, that they should clarify that reasonable accommodation under the ADA may require more than that. And so we are aware of this issue that employees don't know that they can ask for something beyond the 1 year. And certainly, we're looking, into whether or not we should be doing more trainings, we should be issuing more, sort of technical assistance guidance, that we should be, somehow other getting information out to employers that they have an obligation. The consent decree in Sears, said that they needed to change their communication methods and that they should make sure that they communicate this information and that they should be in contact with employees during that 1 year. Certainly no employer should give somebody a year and not have any contact with the person and then say, oh, it's 366, this is a 366 day, and you're out. I mean, they should be having ongoing communication with the person.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the queue?
We do have another question from Gary Edler.
Hi, my name is Lenore Camisa. I'm with the Ohio Rehabilitation Services Commission. It sounds like the definition of a disability along with functional limitations have changed a little bit with rehabilitation agencies in different states. We typically use the ADA as a guidance in order to determine eligibility in order of selection for vocational services. Has anybody been working with the Rehabilitation Services Administration as far as like enforcing these changes?
Do I say you were aware of whether or not there's been any collaboration or related to the RSA or Rehab Services Administration within the Department of Ed on this?
No, I'm not.
No, wow. Okay.
So it probably is definitely something that, Lene Rutledge is the commissioner and such, hopefully they're aware of and maybe have plans or are looking at, but sounds like there may not be anything formally in place.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Not that I'm aware.
Thank you. Any additional questions be in the queue? I've got some from the online that I'll intersect here.
There are no further questions.
Okay. I've got a question here that somebody's asking related to the fact that under the ADA AA, it calls for the definition of disability to be modified in Section 504 and other related regulations within the ADA. And this is for you, Allison. What is the status of the Department of Justice's efforts to update your regulations to reflect the definition of disability that's within the ADA AA?
Let me give you two answers to that. First, with respect to us, yeah, that is one of the things that's underway. The other is that all of the federal agencies will now have to amend their 504 regs, and we, of course, are also charged with overseeing and coordinating that, and that process is also ongoing.
Do you think is that something that would be, where we're looking at, you know, the next year kind of a thing? I mean, I know it takes a while for regulations to be developed and then published and comment and all those kinds of things, so is this a year process, or do you have any sense of that?
You know, I actually don't, and I think that one of the things that is challenging all federal agencies at the moment in every aspect of what they're doing is we have, you know, tremendous budgetary constraints, and so I don't know if that will play a role in this, but it seems to be playing a role a little bit in everything. So I hate to put time frames around that stuff, but regardless of the change, the law – regardless of when the actual regs are changed, it is still the law that there's a conforming amendment to 504 that so that when courts are looking at these questions of who's disabled under 504, they are going to be looking at the language of the Amendments Act.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Thank you. And, Allison, could you we get a lot of calls in the ADA network related to materials and fact sheets, and when is DOJ going to be updating, you know, some of their multitude of documents and things. And while we've seen a few things coming out, got the primer for small business and that addresses some of the changes in the regulations, and you see, you know, a service animal document and a ticketing document, what's kind of the time frame? Again, I'm sure you're going to talk about some constraints with staff and monies and things that ensure to ensure that a lot of your documents that are affected by the changes in the regulations are available to help people understand these changes and what to do with them.
Well, I think you'll see two things. We have a lot of technical assistance documents, so the notion that every one of our technical assistance documents that that was developed and produced under the last set of regulations is going to be updated either at all or quickly, I think it's probably not correct. I think we're trying to prioritize new documents and prioritize amending the older technical assistance documents that are the most widely used. So I think you'll see those done in sort of a priority list. And what was the second part of your question?
I think that was the same part. It was all just about what the status, and I just gave you some examples of things that you already have.
Sorry. That was so you'll see that we will be updating our TA documents. The first few are out, and there certainly will be more. The other thing is I think you'll see new technical assistance documents developed as we begin to be informed by people in the public, the parts of the regulations that they're dealing and they're struggling with the most, the things that they feel that there is insufficient guidance on, even under the old regulations. So I think you'll see whole new documents also being created. And, you know, we're moving apace, but, again, there are a lot of documents, so it is going to take some time.
Great. Thanks. Well, I think it gives people an idea of what to expect or, you know, what's out there in that regard.
Sure.
Also, can you speak a little bit to the efforts that, obviously with the new regulations, and there's been a lot, you know, it takes a while when you think back of 20 years and think of, you know, starting in 1991, 92, when the regulations started to go into effect and how long it took for entities to kind of gear up to compliance and such. Recognizing that the regulations, the majority of them, went into effect this last March 15th, some architectural standards and things going into effect next year. What efforts or what thoughts does the Department of Justice have related to ongoing enforcement monitoring related to these things? I mean, you know, for example, the ticketing regulations and the major changes there for purchasing and obviously the number of entities that this impacts, everything from their websites and how they promote their purchasing and such to the actual doing of it. What kind of efforts or relationships has Department of Justice looked at to help address some of the ongoing enforcement and awareness issues around these things?
Well, a couple things. I think these, first of all, I think this set of regulations differs from the initial set because the law has been around for 20 years. So while the first set of regulations were really new to everybody because the law was new, particularly with respect to the architectural standards, now you can make the argument that, you know, disability law in some form had been around since 1973, but I think for the private sector, that's something that they didn't focus on. That's really, that would only really be true for the federal government and federal financial recipients. So I think the fact is that the ADA has been now a part of people's lives for a very long period of time. So I think coming out with the second set of regulations and the changes that are contained in there, you're looking, you know, that information is going out into a wholly different, much more informed world than the first set. So we are continuing to move the message about the regulations and people's obligations and responsibilities, you know, in the same way that we always have. We're still running a hotline. Our website gets more hits than any other website at the Department of Justice. We are continuing to both update and to do outreach through new technical assistance documents. We do speeches. We do calls like this. I mean, we're doing the same level of outreach, the greatest level of outreach that we can frankly afford to do. And beyond that, it's hard for me to foresee ways in which we aren't moving the message already, but if people have suggestions for how we should be moving the message, you know, we're certainly always happy to have that conversation.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any additional questions from anybody, Jamie?
No, I'm showing no questions.
Okay. I guess we're almost at the bottom of the hour here, so I guess we have a very silent audience, or they felt that you guys gave some great information, or the stuff that's been coming out from your agencies and other places have been so comprehensive, everybody's feeling that they are feeling pretty comfortable with what they know, and that's great. So I'll just give each of you just the last opportunity to make a comment, and then we'll wrap up the session.
I'm hoping that, you know, the lack of questions is not because they prefer Sharon Renner from our office or John Wodak from Justice. But anyway, I will give my email address again if there are questions that people have, and that's joyce.walker-jones@eeoc.gov, and I do respond to all the emails. You might have to give me a little bit. I am leaving for vacation tomorrow, so I may not get back until 1st of August, but I will respond. The other thing is I would say, you know, to continue to check our website. As I said, we are updating our documents. I can't promise when they will all be updated, but we are in the process of doing that, and as soon as they are updated, we will post them and put some kind of notification that, you know, that they have been updated. We're also looking at, you know, the possibility of issuing new guidance or new technical assistance documents. So I would just suggest that anyone should frequently visit our website at www.eeoc.gov.
And I would close with the same. First of all, thank you all for participating in this and for allowing the Department of Justice to be part of your event today. ADA.gov, if you want to know every time something new happens at the department, all you need to do is sign up for the email alerts there. So then every time there's a new settlement, a new brief, a new technical assistance piece, anything having to do with the ADA, you'll be alerted, and then you can go on the website and see what that is. And our information line, again, is always open for business. If you want to connect with any individual, where all of our emails are available on ADA.gov, and we certainly welcome any and all questions that you might have.
Great. Well, thank you both, Allison and Joyce. It's sincerely appreciated your time and your efforts of your agencies and your own personal time, and we are thrilled to have you, Allison, working with us, as the ADA National Network has enjoyed a great relationship with the Department of Justice over the years, and hope that will continue.
Absolutely.
So thank you, everyone who has participated today and has been engaged with us, and we hope that the information was useful to you. As I indicated, the session was recorded, and we will be posting it in the archive section of the www.ada-audio.org website. We encourage you to contact the regional ADA center that serves your geographic area, as we are available to provide you assistance and information on a variety of issues related to the ADA, and you can do that by contacting us at 800-949-4232. That's both voice and TTY. If you're not familiar with which particular center serves your geographic area, you can go to the national website, which is www.adata.org, and that will give you a clickable link to the center that serves your geographic area, and as well as some other resources that we have available as a national network. So again, thank you, everyone. I want to remind you about our session in August. Our session for August is August 16th, and we'll be addressing ADA and alternative dispute resolution and mediation. We are featuring some speakers from the Key Bridge Foundation. The focus of the session is really just to talk about how mediation plays into ADA-related disputes. We also have representatives who will be joining us from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, as well as the Department of Justice Mediation Program, to give you a sense of how their specific programs actually do work and how you might be able to use their specific programs. But the focus of the session is really on what is mediation, how is it used, and how has it been used successfully. So we invite you to join us for that session. And then in September, we will be focusing on marketing for accessibility within the hospitality industry, looking at the changes to the ADA regulations, what that means, and what hoteliers and others need to be thinking about as we move forward in this new era of the ADA. So we invite you to join us for both those sessions to round out this particular fiscal year for us, and then we'll be looking forward to the future and a new set of sessions for next year. So thank you, everyone, and have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, Robin.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference for today. Again, thank you for your participation. You may all disconnect.